Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. Today, host David Bell talks with Judge Laura Denver Stith, who has recently retired from the Supreme Court of Missouri. After serving 20 years as a member of that court, including as Chief Justice from July of 07 through June of 09, Judge Stith calls her service as a judge on the court the honor of a lifetime. When he announced her retirement, Chief Justice George W. Draper III said, "Judge Laura Denver Stith's resume and body of work speak for themselves. She will leave a lasting legacy in the areas of ethics, gender, and justice. Her experience, intelligence, diligence, and wisdom will be missed." Judge Stith will speak on her unique perspective, giving our listeners an overview of 20 years of criminal and social court issues in Missouri. We'll air our calendar at the middle of the hour. We hope you will listen. Listeners will receive the honor of a lifetime to hear Judge Stith. Certainly, Jaws of Justice is honored to have her as our guest. Justice will not be served until those who are unaffected are as outraged as those who are. Now, our show.
When I first began learning more about Judge Stith, I became hyper-focused on her being only the second woman to serve as a judge on the Missouri Supreme Court. And with that filter firmly in place, I tried to find those bits of information that fit the narrative I was creating. I read some of Judge Stith's opinions, spoke with a few individuals, including a former law clerk, and of course spoke on multiple occasions with Judge Stith. And what I found and what I hope to share with you today is something much more powerful, yet at the same time much more nuanced. While Judge Stith has certainly had to overcome challenges to reach one of the most respected positions in our society, including Chief Justice of the Missouri Supreme Court, and while I certainly admire and respect the heights reached, I developed a much greater appreciation for the manner in which she has chosen, in her own words from a recent presentation, not to be silent or quiet. In every interview, I strive to learn something for myself that I can use in my own personal development, and I hope that our listeners learn as well. Listen closely today, and I promise you will learn something that will help you in your own life. And with that, I welcome Judge Stith. Judge, thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Could you very briefly give us just a little bit of background about yourself, kind of where you grew up, where you were born, maybe where you went to school, and how you chose to go into the legal field?
Sure. I grew up in St. Louis. I was the fourth of five kids, went to school in Clayton, Missouri, and that area through grade school and high school, like a parochial grade school, private high school, and then went to Tufts University to college, which is in Boston, and then to Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. But I wanted to come back to Missouri, so I did, and came back as a law clerk at the Supreme Court of Missouri.
You know, looking at your background a little bit and your family in particular, and we'll talk about one member of your family, I wonder if you were destined to become not only a lawyer, but destined to become a judge, if there is such a thing. Looking back on your career, do you find that to be true? You were going to be something like a lawyer, someone who was going to make a difference in the world?
Yes, actually, that was, I attribute it in large part to how I was raised and the family I was raised in. I had two incredible parents, Ann Carter Stith and Richard Stith, Dick Stith, most people call them, who were incredibly active in the St. Louis civic community. They were very involved in working on causes that were important to them, such as education, such as prison reform, such as community relationships, getting to know others, such as ending desegregation. Every night when we grew up, we would have dinner from 6 to 6:30, and we would just talk about everything that was going on in our community and going on in the country from the time we were young children. And it was just part of our being growing up in that family, that it was your obligation to be part of that larger community and to give back to it. I also grew up and became kind of age during the Watergate era. And at that time, I looked on lawyers as heroes, as did many of my siblings. And we ended up with four of the five of us becoming lawyers, because we thought that was the best avenue for us then to become involved in our communities in a way that might make a difference. And the fifth became a journalist and for the Post-Dispatch and covered the courts.
You know, sitting around the dinner table and talking about issues of the day, and being part of the community. I wonder, was every child given their moment to have their opinion known? Meaning, was every child's opinion, they were given a moment to make their peace? Whatever it was, whatever their age was, whatever their intellectual ability was, they were listened to.
We were all listened to, but we weren't given a moment. We didn't have to come up with something to say in a particular day. It was more trying to get your words in edgewise among your other right. very talkative siblings.
Sure.
It was just a wonderful family-focused discussion back and forth where everyone's opinion was respected, but it was up to you to voice it. What they did was make sure each of us understood that our voice was important.
Starting off, I was talking about a particular family member, and that was your mother. And you relayed a story to me about a grand jury proceeding that your mother had then relayed back to you. And if you could briefly tell the listeners about that interaction that your mom had with a prosecutor at the time.
I will. This would have been in the early 60s, and my mother just happened to be asked to be on a state grand jury. It was in St. Louis County, and she went to the first meeting of the grand jury, and there were no rules, there were no books, that she had been sent no instructions. So she asked the prosecutor, well, how do we know what to do? And he said, oh, you just listen to me, little lady. Well, my mother took that as a challenge to learn more so she wouldn't have to depend on somebody telling her, you should do what I say. She was a very independent woman. And so she went to my father, who had had a year of law school and knew how to do legal research. And he showed her how to use the county law library and explained about legal citations. And she did research and wrote a book called The Grand Jury, Who It Is, What It Is, What It Does. It was really about a pamphlet of about 20 pages. And St. Louis County used it for about 20 years, giving it to their grand jurors when they came to help them understand what their role was. And from that, she went on to get involved in criminal justice issues. She worked on a number of state committees dealing with alternatives to imprisonment, dealing with visiting jails and prisons and looking at conditions there, and generally working to improve how the justice system works. So she also was involved in fact, chaired the effort to build what was in the New County Jail in Gumbo, Missouri, which is the St. Louis County Jail now.
You know, it was curious, that interaction, I guess part of me, I was trying to place myself in your mother's shoes at that moment in time, and I was, I was wondering how I would have dealt with it. I guess I thought of physical force right there, you know, or some expletives or complaining to somebody. And yet the one thing that she did probably had the most impact on the most people with regard to the problem she was trying to correct. And she did it with it sounds like, without much fanfare, meaning I'm sure the comment little lady stung and may have given her a little extra energy, but she didn't lose sight, it seems to me, of the kind of what made her approach the prosecutor in the first place. I don't know anything about this. What am I supposed to do? He dismisses her, and she chooses to get that knowledge and then share it with as many people as possible.
Exactly. That was her approach. In fact, she was one of the founders of Call for Action in St. Louis, which is a group that if someone was not being listened to by utilities or landlords or whatever, they would give them a voice and find someone who could help them. That was just her nature and how I grew up. The answer to a problem is to try to help others find a solution and find one yourself, not just to complain. Not that it's not fun to complain, but
I've done it. Sure. And this family involved in the community, I wonder, in St. Louis at the time, what does that mean to become involved in the community, at least as you learned it from your parents and at least as you've tried to continue with that through your career?
Well, I think I may have mentioned to you my first recollection of being involved in community affairs was when I was 10 or 12 years old. My mother enlisted me to help her come up with some jingles that we would put on the radio about the bond issue for the new county county jail, which is kind of an unusual experience for a 10 or 12 year old. And I recall going around the neighborhood and talking to neighbors about that. And after that point, volunteering in neighborhood organizations for particular issues. I got involved in tutoring. I got involved in just small ways with student groups and other groups trying to affect change in the small ways you do as a student in a local community. But I realized if I wanted to get involved in making sure justice was done on a broader scale, law was the way to do that. And as I said, Watergate really inspired me to realize that not everybody respects the law as much as we've been raised to respect the law. And becoming a lawyer was a great way to try to preserve the respect for the rule of law.
When you were on the Missouri Supreme Court, I know that one of the issues that was important to you was that of ethics, particularly for the legal profession. And I was wondering if you could briefly describe, very briefly, for the listeners. I do remember taking ethics in law school, so I would ask very briefly. But what is it for purposes of law profession, and what does the Missouri Supreme Court have to do with it?
Well, legal ethics has to do with the behavior of lawyers in representing their clients. And we have, despite all the lawyer jokes, the legal profession is actually a very heavily regulated and a very ethical profession. And if someone is not ethical, we want to hear about it because we require them to take courses in ethics. We require them to take continuing education programs in ethics. And we have many, many rules governing how they have to deal honestly with their clients and with the courts. And 99% of lawyers do that. But there's bad apples in every group. And there's also people who through unfamiliarity with some of the rules that we would like them to be familiar with, make mistakes and violate the rules. So what we do is we provide programs for lawyers to understand better how to manage their practices and how to deal with their clients. And we provide a discipline system for those who cannot do that. And we can discipline them by suspending them, by disbarring them, or by more limited sanctions, which simply say this is a reprimand. If you do this again, a more serious sanction will be imposed. But we can also, we found that being punitive is not always the best way. Sometimes people just need education. So we really encourage law schools to provide education on the rules of professional conduct. And I've worked really hard in the last number of years to make those rules clearer for lawyers to understand, because I think most people, if they understand the rules and why they're important, will try to follow them. So we've tried to simplify the rules. We've tried to provide some, if someone maybe has a mental health issue or an issue dealing with alcohol that is causing them problems, provide avenues for them to get the help they need so they can get back to the good practice of law and helping people, as most lawyers want to do.
You know, in talking to you, Judge, one of the issues that you took up as part of the court was trust accounting. And just yes. So everyone's aware, when money's received, and it's intricate, but when money's received from attorneys, it's to be placed essentially in many cases in a trust account. It is essentially being viewed by someone outside the organization. There's a number of rules about transferring from that to being earned income. And I don't want to go into the intricacies of trust accounting, because I can tell you that it doesn't make for good dinner conversation. However, at the same time, I was fascinated by your interest in it, because it reminded me to a certain extent, as I was looking for a theme, of in a way something your mother with the grand jury, meaning it's something that is not going to, it's not sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's not going to make headlines, but it's going to impact an infinite number of people, and they may not even realize it. Is that, how did you choose trust accounting of all things to focus on?
Well, and the court as a whole did that. We realized that there's a lot of lawyers who are very good lawyers, but not very good business people, and they do not really know how to manage money as well as they should. So we needed to have some rules in place to make sure their clients' money, if they won a case for their clients, it was put in a special account where it couldn't be touched by the lawyers or by their lawyers' creditors if they owed people, but it was preserved for the clients. And that's what the purpose of the trust account is. There are a lot of complicated rules that accountants put in place for that govern these trust accounts, and lawyers are usually not accountants. So it used to be in the rules that there would be a reference to these accounting rules, and lawyers had to go find them. And we brought those legal requirements in and put them in a regulation under the rules so that it would be easy for lawyers to find and much easier to follow than they had been, say, 15 years ago before that happened. And then with our chief disciplinary counsel goes out and has programs on how to follow those trust rules, has a list of things you can do to make sure you're following the rules correctly. And we have programs to help people who make mistakes if they're inadvertent in learning how to improve it. There's a few bad apples who don't properly use their trust accounts because they don't take the care and don't care about taking the care as they should for their lawyers, for their clients' money. And for those, we have more severe sanctions of discipline. But the idea is to get the information out there so people can help themselves, but they can't unless you give them the information. And I guess that is the tie-in to my mother's work, that grand jurors can't do the proper job if they don't know the rules that govern their conduct, that no one can.
By the way, thank you for linking those for me. I'm looking for a constant theme. You know, one of the themes that I found with learning more about you, Judge, is allowing voices to be heard and drawing the best from people. You know, I, as an appellate judge, you're looking at a transcript, maybe some exhibits, perhaps hearing arguments from lawyers. And I, at least from my perspective, it can appear at first blush to be a bit cold, but I wanted to read you something that a previous law clerk provided to me. And indicated the following. It says, when Judge Stith trains her attention on you, she's listening. She's present. Some people listen so they can respond. Judge Stith listens so she can understand. She brings that to her work on the bench. You know, when I spoke to persons about you, there's an undeniable warmth and respect for others that emanates from you. And I wonder, is that something that's conscious on your part? Or is this the first time you're hearing it? Or are you consciously, intentionally trying to provide that space for people so that whatever is the best of them will come out?
That's exactly right. Not that it's the first thing on my mind every day, but it is underlying my whole approach to being a judge, that we don't have all the answers and on our own. We have lawyers who file briefs, have oral arguments before us. They provide us with the best information. Sometimes that can be an intimidating task to have seven. In the case of the Supreme Court, there's seven judges who are staring at you as you're trying to make an argument before them. And sometimes it can prevent you from presenting your best arguments. The purpose of oral argument is to help the court determine justice in an individual case and to answer questions the court might have and to give you a chance to give the court your best argument for why your client should win. And so I want to encourage lawyers to feel comfortable doing that, to feel that we're really listening. I try to look at exactly at anyone who's speaking. I try to listen carefully to their arguments, and I ask questions back and forth so there's a dialogue so they understand the court really is listening to the issues that are before them. And I find that causes them to make the best argument for the clients that they can because they know they have an audience that wants to understand. And I apply that to other areas of work. So if I'm talking to visiting school groups, whether it's a visiting leadership group or whether it's an eighth grade group or some of the most fun groups that come to visit the court and learn about their court system are fourth graders. Fourth graders are still very interested in learning and not at all jaded. So you get some very, very fun questions from them. But each time, treat those students with respect. Let them know you want to know what their concern is and what their questions are, and you care about those questions and want to give them an honest answer. And I've just found people are energized by that and more interested in their legal system than they ever have been before. I've gotten letters from lots of school children who I've spoken to telling me how that was the highlight of their visit to Jefferson City and how much it meant to them to have someone like a judge who listened to their questions and cared. And I think everybody needs to know that people in authority care.
But I wonder, is this listening? I mean, actually listening, not so much just, all right, what am I going to say next when this person is done talking, but actually listening to the words being spoken and considering them. Is that a learned skill? Is that something, is that a genetic thing for you? How does that come about for you? And how may others, do you think, learn to develop that further if they want to?
Well, I think those family dinners were an important part of it, where we would all know that whatever we said was important and would be respected. And where if we were the oldest or the youngest, we would get a chance if we wanted to speak. I also think it's just my nature. Even in the family, they would call me the peacemaker because I would listen to everybody's side and figure out some solution in the middle. And to me, that's the ideal. Trying to find the piece of truth in everybody's argument and find some common ground they can have that can resolve a situation, whether it's a conflict and it's in a mediation or whether it's a family argument or whether you're trying to piece together two conflicting areas of law. We have to figure out the answer in a particular case and maybe prior cases conflict on how to deal with that situation. I often can find some way in which they don't conflict, in which you can honor the principles behind both aspects of the law and try to do that.
Well, that's interesting. So we're talking about not just honoring the viewpoints of allowing people to be heard, listen to them, but also using that same skill and finding a common ground between two areas of law that may at first blush appear to be completely opposite of each other.
Absolutely. I think it comes from, some people call it thinking outside the box, but I just think trying to be open to other viewpoints. And you may have something you feel, but understanding that other views, other histories, other decisions are valid too, and trying to understand why people might come to them. And then you can, if you understand the reason why the law is a certain way, you can better apply it to new fact situations or to resolve disagreements.
As we close out this first half of the show, another story that I had heard from a few people was how when children were brought by your chambers or to the court, that in many cases you made a point of allowing them to wear your robe. And I was struck by that in so many ways, in that kind of what you're instilling in that person. And I wonder if you could just briefly talk about that and why you find it so important to do such a simple act, but something that could be so meaningful to children.
Putting on the robe lets them feel like, for that moment, understand a little bit about what it is to be a judge, but moreover, to picture themselves as a decision maker, as someone important. They're not simply someone looking up at the front of the room and seeing somebody speak to them. They are in the judicial robe. I let them sit in my chair on the bench, and they think, you know, I could sit here one day for real. It just gives them that little bit of inspiration that they may need to believe in themselves enough to go ahead and fulfill all their capabilities and not get discouraged by the things that all of us sometimes face in life, which can be discouraging and which require a lot of belief in yourself sometimes to get through. And it just makes them connect to the law more too and care about it more because it makes it real. A judge is not some hypothetical person they see on the TV, but they've actually worn the robe and sat in the chair. And so justice becomes more real to them and more a part of their lives.
So I love the idea of it. You've given them some knowledge. You've let them know they're important or they are meaningful in that you've listened to what they have to say. You've considered it. You've engaged with them. And now you have actually let them wear the robe. It almost sounds like a virtual reality experience, but in a more in-depth way so that if being a judge is something they want to do in the future, they have tasted it for a moment and it's reachable by them. It's not something so far out in the distance like that's just an impossibility, but I did it and I could do it again.
Exactly. The reachability is key. I've talked to a number of young people too. I've had neighbors and friends call and say, particularly as a young woman, I know a young woman who doesn't have any family or friends in which the mother has gone on to become a professional or become a leader, but they're really interested in doing that, but think, gosh, this is impossible. Could they come talk to you and about how they did that and just talk to someone who's been successful as a woman so they can see that they shouldn't be daunted by some fear that they won't be accepted? And I've done that for a number of young women, and it's really it makes me appreciate how lucky I was to grow up in the family I grew up in, who just told us we could do whatever we wanted to do and be whatever we wanted to be. We just had to work really hard to get to it. And that's not true for everybody, but if you don't even picture it as a possibility, you can't get there. At least if you believe it's possible, you can maybe get help in overcoming the other obstacles that you have.
We're speaking with Judge Stith. We're now going to break to play calendar and other announcements. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Judge Stith more about letting people's voices be heard. This is 98.1 KKFI. You're listening to Jaws of Justice.
This is Alice Kitchen with the Women's Equality Coalition. Discrimination against women has followed us through the ages. A number of myths need to be spelled out. Myth number one, we women are in the Constitution. Even though 38 states have ratified the Equal Rights Amendment, but not Missouri, we have the threshold that is needed to be a constitutional amendment. And yet, because of a little-known tag that was put on this process a number of years ago, it instilled a deadline that we have to overcome. So this Congress needs to remove that deadline. So it matters a lot because women, we don't have the same standing as cases that have to do with race, age, and disability. Myth number two, wages. People think that women are paid the same as men. Wrong. A recent study shows that when you compare men and women based on education, experience, and skills all the same, Asian women make 90 cents on the male dollar. White women make 79 cents on the male dollar. Black women, 62 cents. Hispanic women, 54 cents. Native American women, 57 cents. And it makes a big difference in retirement. So as you make less money over the years, your retirement is greatly reduced. Myth number three, it is okay for an employer to ask you your salary history in the hiring process. No, it is not okay in Kansas City, Missouri, and it matters because we women are in and out of the workforce more often than men due to pregnancy, childbearing, and rearing, and caring for aging parents. So in summary, discrimination does exist today. It exists in many forms, and we need you to recognize it and to call it out. The views expressed here are my own and not necessarily those of KKFI.
Now the calendar for the week of March 22nd. In compliance with Mayor Lucas' emergency order, ensure necessary public health measures remain in place. See the facts at kcmo.gov. If you're behind on your mortgage, Legal Aid of Western Missouri may be able to provide you with free legal advice and services. If you're a resident of Jackson County, you can give them a call, 816-474-6750. You can check to register for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America events this week at momsdemandaction.org. Monday Meets is 4 p.m., an online event hosted by the Willow Domestic Violence Center, open to everyone on Facebook Live. Also Monday, March 22nd, today, noon, No More Excuses Coalition meeting at the Mohart Center Auditorium, 3200 Wayne, Kansas City, Missouri. No Excuses Coalition will meet every first and fourth Monday of the month. Thursday, March 25th, 6 p.m., Smash the Patriarchy, 6 p.m., an online event. There's a lecture and discussion exploring the history of patriarchy. It's Women's History Month. Contact the Emily Taylor Center for Women and Gender Equity for access info. Friday, March 26th at 12:30 p.m., Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty Monthly Meetup, which this month is a virtual workshop on death penalty advocacy with Naeem Al-Amin of SWAG Incorporated, a Kansas City nonprofit focused on reducing recidivism. Register at madp.org. Saturday, March 27th, there's a social justice teach-in, Memoria y Resistencia, Reflections on Self-Identity and Communal Legacy. Access info on Eventbrite. A list of services, meals, and hotlines are available at lawrenceprogressivecalendar.blogspot.com. That list is updated daily. Please take care of yourselves and others. The COVID pandemic has brought into sharp focus the need for health care reforms that promote universal access to affordable care. COVID-19 has devastated the U.S. prison and jail population. My name is Terry, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Stan Thomas. Now we return to our show, David Bell speaking with Judge Laura Denver Stith.
Hi, this is David Bell, and you're listening to 90.1 KKFI. I'm here today speaking with Judge Stith, and we're talking about her approach to the court, also very much so her approach to just interacting and engaging with others around her and bringing out the best from them. You know, Judge, we've talked in the first half about letting your or letting voices be heard, if you will. And that brings me to a case that I know the court decided while you're there, and that was Wineshank versus Missouri. And I know that was a seminal case for the court, and I believe you're an active member of the per curiam majority. I wonder if you could briefly talk about that case, what was the issue in the case, and then perhaps how it was decided, to give us an idea, again, in the context of allowing voices to be heard.
Sure. The Wineshank case was decided in late 2006 and had to do with a requirement the legislature had passed for voters to present photo IDs in order to vote. Now, a couple of years previously, Missouri had passed a law that required, in fact, a number of years previously, that required voters to present an ID, but the ID might be their Social Security card or a utility bill or something else that showed where they lived and what their name was that was current. But the photo ID requirement required them to present a state or federally issued photo ID, which had an expiration date, and it was prior to the expiration date. In effect, all they could show was either a passport, a Missouri driver's license, or something called a Missouri non-driver's license, which is for those who don't drive but need a photo ID. The problem is that there are about 3 to 4%, some couple hundred thousand Missourians who don't have any of those types of ID, yet have been voters for years, have been registered, have been voting at their polling sites, are known by the poll workers to be who they claim to be, but under this new requirement would not be able to vote. So the question was whether that violated their right to vote, their constitutional right to vote under Missouri law. And the court held, the majority of the court held that, yes, it did indeed violate their right to vote. Missouri actually has some provisions in its constitution that are even stronger than in the U.S. Constitution that give those who are registered the right to vote. And we found this was an undue burden on that right because it required them to undertake actions that were they might have to spend 6 months trying to get the identification they needed to present in order to get a driver's license or a non-driver's license. Also, it would cost them money. I should explain a little bit. In order to get a driver's license, the statute provided that you could get one for free or get a non-driver's license for free if you needed it to vote. But the problem was to get a non-driver's license for, quote, free, you had to pay to get underlying documents showing who you were. So a birth certificate and certain other kinds of identifying documents, and those cost money. And if you were from another state, then the documents might have been destroyed, and so you would have to go through a 3 to 6 month process to try to find substitutes if you could at all. The result was that, according to the witnesses in that case, there were hundreds of thousands of people who couldn't vote. We said that was both a financial burden and a time burden on the right to vote, and that it was improper. One way the case is relevant to today still is that that argument was made that, well, there was a perception that there was cheating among people who voted in person, and so that we should approve requiring these kind of photo IDs despite that cheating, even though the record showed that, in fact, there was no in-person cheating. There hadn't been a case of in-person cheating in Missouri in a dozen years. But the argument went, well, people perceive there is in-person cheating. So even if there's not, we should require these photo IDs. And what the court said was, first, that perception of something that's not true should not outweigh a constitutional right given to all the people of Missouri to vote. But the second is that could lead to an intentional creation of that perception as a justification for limiting the right to vote. And that should not be permitted, that you can't create false perceptions and then use them to justify a denial or limitation of the right to vote. And for that reason, the court in 2006 struck down that law.
Oh, that's fascinating. So that second part, Judge, is it the idea that you could, that if I wanted to, potentially, I could go out and create an issue where there wasn't an issue, so give people the perception of it, and then say, Judge, we've got a terrible problem here. it's not substantive in the thing, but rather the perception of the thing. And we need a corrective action in order to defend against the perception itself.
Right.
It almost sounds scary. I mean, in a way.
That is exactly what the court said. And the court said in that case, the perception had developed, the people who were making the argument were not the ones who had created a false perception. The false perception was just there. And we said a false perception can't justify limiting the right to vote. But we also said if it could, then you would raise the specter of someone trying to create one on purpose in order to do that, which is even scarier.
Oh, wow. So the next case I briefly wanted to talk to you about was the Roper case. This was a case that was decided under the federal constitution by a state court, as I understand it. And just to sort of clear the listeners, the Wineshank case was decided under Missouri law. Is that right? The Missouri constitution.
Yes. Yes.
And in some cases, the Missouri constitution, the United States constitution are kind of coextensive. They both, say the same thing, or they've both been interpreted to say the same thing. In the Roper case regarding juvenile death penalty, you authored the majority opinion, which held that executing individuals for crimes committed while juveniles was unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. If you could briefly talk to listeners about that and the ramifications of that, because that seemed to be obviously a very seminal case in jurisprudence, at least with regard to the Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment provision.
It is, and I think as most people know, our U.S. Constitution provides that cruel and unusual punishment shall not be imposed. But what is cruel and unusual punishment? It doesn't make a list of them. It leaves it to future generations to figure out what that is. But it makes very clear that that kind of punishment cannot be imposed. So in the late 1980s, the U.S. Supreme Court said, executing people who committed, say, a murder when they were 14 or 15 is cruel and unusual punishment. Those are children, and they don't know the full ramifications of what they did. They may be guilty, but it would be wrong to assume they can't learn and be better as they grow and mature. And so we should not impose death as a punishment. But they said that's not true for 16 and 17-year-olds. Around the same time, they said that someone who was intellectually disabled and committed a murder, there was no bar, that was not cruel and unusual punishment to execute them, even though they were intellectually disabled. Well, about 12 years later, they revisited the issue of whether you could execute someone who was intellectually disabled at the time of their crime, and they said, you know, a number of states have found that that is improper now, and looking overall at our evolving standards of decency, we think that it is now, in light of our collective community consciousness of right and wrong, it would be wrong to execute these people if part of the reason they did what they did was because they were intellectually disabled. So they would be put in prison, given assistance, but they could not be executed for their crime. Well, then at that point, a case came before us of this young man named Simmons who had killed someone when he was 17 years old. He'd received the death penalty, and we were being asked to sign a death warrant, which would be allow him to be executed. His counsel said, we believe that now our collective consciousness would say it would be cruel and unusual to execute Mr. Simmons because of his lack of maturity at the time of his crime, and please look at this issue. So we were presented with the question, does the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause forbid executing him? The last time the Supreme Court had looked at that, 12, 15 years earlier, they said it did not. But in the interim, another five states had said you can't execute juveniles. A number of state legislatures had said you cannot. Missouri still allowed you to. But we had to decide as the highest court in Missouri, whatever Missouri statutory law said, did this violate the federal constitution? And we held by 4-3 vote in a majority opinion I did write that yes, it did, that evolving standards of decency had evolved to the point where we believed in light of the lesser maturity of juveniles and their chance for rehabilitation as they grew older and more mature, their brains fully developed, it would be improper to execute them. Well, that case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it decided on a 5-4 basis that we were right, looking at the very cases we had looked at and following our reasoning and saying, yes, we had accurately predicted what they would do, that they found it was a violation of the cruel and unusual punishment clause. The result was that not just Mr. Simmons, but about 72 other juveniles around the country were taken off death row.
You know, there were two parts of this that I found fascinating. Obviously, the underlying subject matter, but two things that were one thing in the decision and one thing that you brought up as we spoke before. And one is this phrase, the judges should be guided by evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of maturing society. And that almost requires you to give voice to this kind of group, exactly what it says, that this evolving standards of decency. And how do you hear those? How do you, you know, I can't put my ear to the ground and hear evolving standards of decency, but yet there has to be some place that you look to for that. And what was that source that you had to listen to or give a voice to in order to be able to make that decision?
Well, the different arguments that were made regarding that issue was the state of Missouri argued that we should only look to our own state legislature. And if they said this is against our collective consciousness of what's right and wrong, then we should not allow it. But if they said it was okay, then it should stop there. What our court found and what the U.S. Supreme Court said was that's not what the U.S. Constitution says. It doesn't say we leave it to the state legislatures to decide whether something is cruel and unusual. It had the broader statement that applied to the whole U.S. Is it cruel and unusual punishment? So you need to look to broader voices. Certainly one of the important voices is what state legislatures do. And while not all of them barred it, between a third and a half did, and they'd all kind of been moving to disallow execution of younger and younger people. But more, they looked to other community voices. So they looked at what physicians thought, what psychiatrists thought, what community groups thought, what religious groups thought. And they got over 100 what are called amicus briefs, friends of the court briefs, where different groups such as those I mentioned filed briefs with the court explaining why they thought it should or should not bar execution of juveniles. The vast majority said they should not. And the court looked at that, looked at its prior cases and what it had found was cruel and unusual in the past and determined that at this point we had evolved to a point where executing those who were under 18 constituted cruel and unusual punishment in light of their special disability because of the fact that they were not yet fully mature. Their brains hadn't fully developed.
You know, when I was speaking about this with you, Judge, before today, one of the things that struck me was a Missouri court reaching out and deciding, essentially deciding a federal, what I consider, the United States Constitutional Eighth Amendment issue that had not yet really been decided by the court. At least I know there were cases that could be read together to say that this is how they would rule, but they had not yet ruled on it. And in fact, the only case in existence was saying it was okay, right, the 16 and 17-year-olds. But yet, had you waited on this, then this defendant would have been executed, meaning you were being asked to sign a death warrant, essentially. And it almost wasn't time to sit around and wait for the Supreme Court to take it up, even if they ever would take it up. Did that play into that at all?
Well, it did, because we had to write assuming we would be the last court to ever look at this request. The U.S. Supreme Court is the highest court in the land and, of course, can decide this or any other issue, and we all follow it. But it decides about 80 cases a year for the whole United States. Half or two-thirds of those come from the federal courts. It'll take a case from Missouri maybe once every 3 to 5 years. And so we could not assume that this would happen to be that case. And in fact, they tend to take cases only where a case conflicts with their prior cases or where two federal courts of appeals reach entirely conflicting opinions. So if we had simply said, well, we're going to follow this earlier case, even though we think it's wrong and we think it violates the community conscience at this time to execute this person, but we're going to do it anyway because we think this case from a decade plus ago requires it, it would be very unlikely they would take that case, and that person would have died because it wouldn't present a conflict, a direct conflict with something they previously said. So we had to assume that whatever we said would be the last word on it, and our job is to do justice for the state of Missouri, and the majority of us didn't feel doing justice was just refusing to decide the case the way we thought justice required because we thought some other court might come in and save the day when we knew the likelihood was that they would not because they've got 50 states to look at, and they can't simply take every case that presents an issue of interest. Mm-hmm.
I want to move very briefly, and as we get closer to the end of our interview, to the Missouri Nonpartisan Court Plan, while I'm surely shifting gears, in a way I think the same theme is there that throughout it. This is something that you worked to defend. It seemed like during your tenure on the Supreme Court, that impacts a significant number of people, and I think but it's one of those things again. It's not sex, drugs, and rock and roll. interesting. But yet it impacts all of us. And I was wondering if you could briefly talk about that and kind of, it seems to me that by it's both parties that it almost, there's this wave of we want to take the power back, and then the Missouri, the nonpartisan plan stays in place. And then the other party comes in and say, no, we want it. And then it's constantly back and forth, but fortunately it's remained. What is it? And very briefly, what fight did you have to, not necessarily fight, but what efforts did you have to make to keep it going the way it is?
Well, the nonpartisan court plan was developed in Missouri. It was the first state to adopt any plan like that in 1940, and it was precisely so that politicians would not try to control the selection of judges. Everybody wants their judge to be unbiased and impartial and not to rule in a certain way because some political party wants them to or some political boss wants them to. Well, in the 1930s in Missouri, unfortunately, there were political bosses who did control a lot of politicians and a lot of judges. So the people by initiative petition adopted the nonpartisan court plan. And it said anyone who wants to be a judge for statewide office or the Court of Appeals or the St. Louis or Kansas City areas, had to apply. You fill out an application form, you apply, you get interviewed, and by a commission that has three lawyers, three lay people appointed by the governor, and is chaired by the Chief Justice. And the idea is that you will pick three qualified people from among those applications, if you the commission, and present those names to the governor. And then the governor selects one of the three. And at that point, they're all three qualified, so it's perfectly fine for the governor to pick any one of the three. But just to make sure that politics doesn't enter in or for some reason someone who's not qualified gets by, then there's a vote after you've been in office at least a year that says, should Judge Blank be retained in office? And the idea is that if somebody's gotten through, if politics too much rather than merit of the individual judge won out, the people can vote the people out. As a result, it was very exciting because my parents got a vote for me when I first got appointed to the Court of Appeals. And then my kids got a vote for me and my parents when I got appointed to the Supreme Court of Missouri. It said, should Judge Laura Denver Stith be retained in office? And they got to say yes. So that was very exciting. My husband was very happy to get to do that also.
But
answering the rest of your question, thank you. When I became Chief Justice in 2007, we happened to have an opening when Ronnie White retired from the court, and there was some concern, I guess some attempts to suggest that maybe we should go back to a different system in which legislators or the governor could have more input on who became a judge, or we should go to an elective system like some states have. And there became a real campaign against the nonpartisan court system. Well, judges don't get involved in politics and get involved in issues most of the time, but the one area of exception is the administration of justice. If we think something is going to make the court system work worse and be unfair, then we have the ability and the obligation to talk about that. And that's what I did. I talked about why the nonpartisan court plan is so good, how it keeps politics out of the selection of judges. I've been a judge for 27 years, and I've never raised a dime to run for office. I've never asked anyone for money. Over in Illinois, just across the river from St. Louis, where they have an elective system, to run for a Supreme Court judge in 2007, one judge, he didn't even spend a political action committee, spent $9 million on behalf of him and his opponent as they vied for that race. And as one of my colleagues said, by the end of it, you wouldn't have voted for either one for dog catcher. You had a third choice because there were all those kind of attack ads that are so horrible that we always hear. But it was about judges, and it made you lose faith in the justice system, even though these were, I'm sure, two perfectly fine attorneys, but they had become part of a political fight among the broader parties and so forth. That really causes people not to trust their justice system. Much better, I think, is the nonpartisan court plan, where you're not allowed to spend money, you're not allowed to campaign, you're not allowed to make promises, you're not allowed to take money. And as a result, not only do we have a system where I think people inherently feel more trust in it because they haven't heard all these horrible advertisements, but we don't feel any antagonism towards each other. The judges, the seven judges on our court, have been appointed by a variety of different governors, come from a variety of different backgrounds, but none of us think of ourselves as representing some particular constituency or viewpoint or political party or anything else. We're simply, our job is to interpret the law and apply it as fairly as we can under the rules and under the statutes. And we all have that same goal, and we work together to do that in a way I don't think we could if we had been fighting each other in some big political election campaign in order to get our jobs.
And, you know, it's interesting, as a litigant or someone who represents litigants, when I go before a judge, I want to be given a fair shake. Obviously, I want the result I want. But regardless of that, because that happens or doesn't happen, I want to believe that I'm being heard and listened to, and I don't have to figure out that I donate to this judge or not donate to this judge or to the other lawyer. I mean, to have to deal with all of that, it just sounds horrific. And I just want to focus on the legal issues themselves. And so I appreciate your work on that. I think, you know, as we come to the end, there was a quote in a presentation that I watched about you, actually a quote from you, that was as follows. It says, and this was regarding your work with LEAP and Operation Breakthrough, I believe. And it was, never wonder whether the small amount of time you spend helping the children makes a difference. It does. The time you spend lets each child know that they matter, they are important, and the adults around them care about them. That extra bit of love and support and respect may be just what they need to see them through difficult times and help them reach their potential. And I will say, Judge, after learning more about you and your history, it seems that this saying describes your approach to all persons. It's just a common theme. You happen to be applying it here to children that you're helping, Operation Breakthrough and LEAP that was associated with that, but it's a common theme to all persons. Did I get that right? Hopefully that common theme that runs throughout this.
You did, absolutely. That is my approach to life and to people. I think you need to help them see and fulfill their potential. And I've been lucky enough to have people help me, and I believe strongly in paying it forward, and in seeing the best in others and trying to help them bring it out.
You know, we started with a story about your mom, and I would ask if we could to end with a story about your mom. And this is a comment that she made to you shortly before her death. And if you could please, and you shared this before, and I would ask if you don't mind to share it again with our listeners.
Sure. My mother knew she was dying, and she was reflecting back on her life with my dad, and she turned to him and she said, you know, I'm really proud of Laura. She's really made a difference in her life. And I just, I said, when we were talking, that is just the greatest honor I ever could have had, is to make a difference in my life, and to know that she felt I had meant more to me than any compliment I've ever had. It was just the greatest positive feeling.
Judge, thank you so much for taking the time to be here with us, for helping me become a better person, frankly, and learning more about you, and for making a difference in my life. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
Sitting here in my prime, What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.
listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.